Mrs. Nursery One, where were you born, please?
In Guildford, in Surrey.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and go to school in Guildford?
Yes, I did, right until the war.
Do you remember Neville Chamberlain declaring war on Germany?
Oh, I do indeed. I remember that Sunday morning. All the women cried. All the women in the family cried.
Did you think it was going to be a long war or a short war?
Do you know, I didn't really give it any thought. I was upset when it happened because my father had been in the First World War and had never really got over it. But I didn't think about it very much.
Which school were you at in Guildford?
I went to a little school called Sandfield and then got a scholarship and went to the central school.
Did the war affect your schooling much?
No, not at all.
Was there any question of your being evacuated?
Oh no, I was, what was...
You were working.
I was working by then. I was a window dresser at one of the best shops in the town.
Were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Not at that time. Later on, when the flying bombs started, and after I'd had my first baby, I was then.
Yes.
And my mother was bombed, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
Mm.
Where were you living when the V weapons were coming over?
In Guildford. I'd gone back to Guildford by then.
Did any V weapons hit the area?
No.
Yes, it did. Up behind your mother.
Was that a V weapon?
Yes.
Oh,
well,
I'm sorry.
V1.
Yes.
Whereabouts did that land?
It landed on the top of a hill behind us. And my mother's house was quite close. She was in the kitchen at the time. And all the windows were blown in. And there was never a scrap of window to show. But everywhere was like... Powdered glass all over the doors and walls. She was uninjured. Didn't make very much of it, really.
What was your address in Guildford at that time?
68 Beckingham Road.
And the name of the hill? Just part of the North Downs.
Westborough, was it?
It was in Westborough, but the hill itself didn't have a name.
No.
How did the war first begin to affect you then?
Well, not until I... Oh, before I went into the ATS, I went into the Land Army. We were friends. Bill went off into the Air Force and I joined the Land Army then. But I had several ailments that, and the doctor said I really shouldn't be in the Land Army. So I thought about it for a bit and then decided to join the Wrens. But when I got there, I then decided, no, it wouldn't be the Wrens, it would be the ATS, because my father had been in the army.
Did you actually start Land Army work?
Oh, yes, I did a year.
Whereabouts?
I started at Poupart's farm in Walton-on-Thames, where we used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to cut lettuce for the market. And then later on, Brussels sprouts we used to cut. We used to pick them with the ice on them. It was horrible work.
How many Land Army girls were working there?
We lived in a hostel, and there must have been 30 or 40. It's a long time ago.
How did you all get on with each other?
Oh, very well. Very well. Most of us, you see, were girls who'd managed to leave home for the first time. We were independent, we were provided with our clothes and food and relied on each other for amusement.
So what kind of living conditions did you have at this farm?
Well, they were pretty awful. We slept in bunk beds. And I remember on one occasion we came back at 9:30 for breakfast always. And I remember somebody saying, oh, I could eat a horse. And the person in front of us who... worked in the kitchen said, well, you probably will, which made us laugh, but I think was probably true.
What was the name of the farm?
Pouparts, P-O-U-P-A-R-T-S. They were very big market gardeners at that time.
What was the supervision like? Was it easy or
harsh?
We
had fairly old men in charge because all the young ones, of course, had gone off into the army or whatever. And so what were left were the oldish men who had no great opinion of girls working.
In what way? Mm-hmm. How did this manifest itself?
Oh, well, they used to tell us we were no good and men would have this done in half the time and all that sort of thing. We never took any notice.
Do you think it was true or untrue?
Oh, I think girls work every bit as hard as men. They talk a lot, but they work fast.
Did you give them any answers back?
Oh, no. Certainly not.
What was the pay like?
£2.50 a week, and we had to pay for our rent and accommodation, so I think, in fact, we had about just a bit over 10 shillings a week as pocket money, which was quite good then, with everything found.
And how long did you have to work for?
I really don't remember. I think... In the summer, we worked till it began to get dark. But of course, in the winter, there wasn't very much to do. I moved on after that because I was very unwell for a while, and I moved on to a farm where they tested guinea pigs and things for foot and mouth disease at Purbright in Surrey. And that was a real farm with animals and rows of beetroot to hoe, all that sort of thing. And there were four of us working there.
What was the name of that farm?
It was the cattle testing station, Purbright, Surrey.
How did you like that?
Very much. It was very nice. I had a job finding digs there. And in the first place, the ploughman offered to put me up in their house with their children, and he invited me for lunch. Well, dinner, they call it. And what we had was a very thick, fatty piece of pork with no lean on it at all, and with boiled potatoes. And then after that, we had custard made with water. And they showed me the room, which was obviously had belonged to the children. It was in a bit of a mess, so I decided not to stay there. Then I moved on. I was offered a place with the Armstrong Jones family. This is Tony Armstrong Jones. It was his stepmother, Carol Coombs. She was an actress. And his father, Major Armstrong Jones, who was a judge advocate.
Where was this?
In Purbright. Still in Purbright.
This was a farm?
No, this was... they owned a big house called Stream House, but they had moved out into the gamekeeper's cottage, which they had had done up by Harrods. And it was absolutely super. And they had a gypsy caravan in the garden, which one of us slept in. There were two land girls. I slept in the house. And I used to cycle to work to the farm from there, but it was rather a long way, so I decided to get a bit closer. And two of the land girls on said, well, come and live with us. And this was on the common at Purbright. And I moved in then, a man who was a fireman at the Scots Guards camp at Purbright, and his wife just took in lodgers, of which I was one. And that was very jolly, very nice.
What kind of duties did you have?
Well, we rowed about 4 miles of beetroot, you know, and hoed out every 4 inches of beetroot seedling. And we took in all the corn and barley and stuff. In those days, they still stooped it. And it was full of little mice and things. I don't mind mice, that's all right. But it was interesting, and I made a terrible mistake. Somebody said to me, to keep your feet warm, you should put straw in the bottom of your boots, which I did, only to find that it was barley straw, which has horrible little hooks in it, and it sticks to your clothes, very uncomfortable.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, that there's some misconception about the diet that people contrived during the war.
Yes, that's right. The food was very plain, but it's never anything like as bad as you read about in papers and books nowadays. And our landlady had, of course, all our rations, and people working on the land had extra cheese. We had an extra half pound of cheese a week, which she worked miracles with. She did all sorts of things. And of course, we used to bring back beetroot from the farm, and she'd make up all sorts of sandwiches and things. She's very good. Her husband had been in the army. He'd been in Malta beforehand.
But I think you were telling me specifically that you don't remember any of the exotic things that are sometimes...
Oh, so I never remember anybody adding banana essence to parsnips and making a banana custard or anything like that. Or... We really weren't hungry either. There was all this dried egg and stuff which we ate, and we weren't hungry. There was enough. They talk as though we were nearly starving sometimes.
To what extent were you conscious of contributing to the war effort?
Well, it sounds too grand to say that. We were all just simply taking part in what went on. I wouldn't have gone into munitions and things like that because I felt people just... I had a cousin who went into it. And she used to work until Wednesday and had them to pay income tax and finished on Wednesday. And even at that age, I didn't approve of that sort of thing. And being on the land, it seemed to be worthwhile.
And can you tell me how you came to leave it, to go into the ATS?
Yes, I was ill again. I had quinsy. And my doctor, who'd known me since birth, said, you really can't go on. You'll have to find something to do indoors.
Was your state of health, poor state of health, because of the land army work?
Well, he said it was. It doesn't seem possible, but he thought I wasn't strong enough for it. I was very healthy, but I did get one or two really bad things in the land army.
And so you told me you went to the ATS via the Wrens.
Yes. I went up to London. I went on, it was Lord Mayor's show day, and I went to the Wren place and had a look at them. And I have a cousin who's in the Navy. In fact, quite a lot of people in there down in New Haven. But for some reason, I just didn't, and I changed my mind and went off and joined the ATS instead on that day.
Where were you trained in the ATS?
Much to my disgust, at the Queen's Camp in Guildford. I quite thought I'd be shipped off somewhere more interesting, but we did the 3 weeks training there.
What did that consist of?
Well, it was quite interesting, really. Well, they did nasty things like pulling out your teeth and giving you jabs and things like that. But it was quite interesting. We did a lot of square batting, it was called, marching about. Went on route marches. And then they taught us in the army way about the pyramid of ranks starting at the top. They taught us all the bugle calls and the funny words that go with them, like officers' wives get puddings and pies and sergeants' wives get skilly, which fits in with the bugle note, all those sort of things.
Can you remember any of them?
That's the only one I can remember at the moment. There was valet. We used to be got up in the morning by a ghastly boy on a bicycle who rode round all the rooms and blew a bugle outside our window, 6 o'clock. Then we went into breakfast. And breakfast was something to be believed. It wasn't too bad at Guildford, But when I moved on, when we moved on to Trowbridge, they used to give us they were under the impression that all girls must eat liver. You see, you needed the iron. And we used to get these awful things like shoe soles on our plates, and you were supposed to eat it up. And you did all sorts of things to get rid of it. Put it in your handkerchief, you know, and got rid of it. Gave it to a dog.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Oh, very well, just like the army, you know, they treat us. We had a very nice sergeant in charge, and the officers, of course, as always, were rather remote. But we have every course had to give an end-of-course concert, and everybody joined in that, and that was great fun. Then we were all sent off. We had to take a test. What's the name? I can't think. To say your IQ test, and we took that, and the people who came up in the top five were sent off to Trowbridge. Officially, we had been told what we were going to do, and mine was the Army School of Camouflage. I was supposed to be going there, which I thought was quite interesting. But anyway, we were put on the train and sent off down to Wiltshire with a lot of other girls, and we were given iron rations, which turned out to be a sandwich, which was about an inch high with a great lump of corned beef inside. Horrible. Nobody ate that either. And we eventually arrived in Trowbridge. Ah, I said to everybody, this is the Army School of Camouflage. No, they said they didn't think it was, and it wasn't. It was the signals. Army Signal Corps.
What happened to you there?
And from then on, we were put on a very intensive course of learning the Morse code and working up the speed. And we did a course in 6 months, which normally took 18 months. And the men were there learning, and we did these things separately. At the same time, we had to do all our army chores, like clearing out the fireplaces and lighting fires to warm up them, invariably smoky and horrible. And we also went on route marches and all this sort of thing. And we did PT. We had PTIs instructing us what to do. And we went through gas. We learned how to cope with gas. We had a nasty man called Sergeant Sillitoe who really didn't like girls at all. And we used to be put through a hut, and then he threw in a gas bomb. And you had to crawl in along the floor to avoid being inhaling this gas. And then he also put a little bit of mustard gas on the back of your hand, so you should know what that was like too. And anyway, we all did this, and we choked and spluttered and came out of it all. But the important thing, of course, was the Morse.
And how did you know that Sergeant Sillitoe didn't like girls?
Well, he made it very clear. And on one occasion, we were on the parade ground doing our marching up and down, and we looked round at him. We were standing there and looked at him, and he was saying, "This is what you do." And he minced along, looking as though he was carrying a little basket in his hand. And so when he looked round next time, it was exactly what we were all doing too. So he sort of was a bit quieter after that, but he's a nasty man, a bit unkind. Then, of course, as I say, the Morse was the important thing. And very interesting girls who were picked for this, they, as I say, all sort of intelligent, clever people, and they've been in some very interesting jobs as you got to know them. And we at this stage knew nothing of what we were doing except that we were learning Morse. And we went from sort of knowing nothing to, I think we've passed out at 18 words a minute there, but of course we got higher later on. I finished up at 27 words a minute.
Did you have any problems with the course?
No, not at all. It was very nice. We were all girls together. We thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. We had time off, went into the town, went on lovely walks up on the Westbury Hills and all that sort of thing. And then Bill, of course, was in Malta at the time, and we had known each other before he went there, because we were young. We grew up in the same town together. And I think I had a telegram saying, ring Beckingham Road. And I'd had a letter from his mother saying Bill had been badly injured, was on his way home. And so I thought, well, I must go and see him. And he was in hospital at Halton, was it? And we asked the sergeant major if I could go and see our commanding officer and ask for time off. And I got in to see her and explain the situation. That my fiancé, although of course he wasn't, we weren't engaged, had come home from Malta and was badly injured, and I would like to go and see him. And she said, no, certainly not, you can't miss out on the course. She was a bit cross about this. We wandered back down, and outside the company office as I went by, there were a whole lot of men lined up, I think four. And I said to the company sergeant major outside, what are they all standing there for? And he said, they're going in to see the commanding officer. So I joined the queue. And I eventually was marched in to see him. He's a funny little man. He had red hair and a little pointed face, and the men called him the weasel, but he was really rather nice. And he's marched in, and he said, yes, what did I want? And I explained the situation, and I said, and I would like to go. He said, damn it, you shall go. And I went, and that was it. But they got their own back, because they made me go down a course, and I wasn't with my own friends when I got back. But I did go. But anyway, in between this, Bill had rung me and asked me to marry him. So I even more wanted to go and see him. And I did, and I got there, and that was it. And then I came back, and they posted me off to Corn, which is in Leicestershire, and I joined another course and went on from there.
Do you think the CO knew that this lady had refused you permission at first?
Well, I don't know. You see, the women ATS officers, nothing like army officers, they had no experience of looking after people. Army officers know what to do. They know when to give way and when to let people do good. She knew nothing, and she was just, just wasn't interested, you know, and thought all girls should get on and do what they're supposed to do.
Had you had any contact with this lady before?
No. Not really. Possibly on paper 8, but that's all.
What rank did she have?
I think she must have been a major. I don't know what they were called then. She probably, if she was in charge, oh, this is Corny, she was probably a major. I'm sure she did what she thought was right, but she gave no thought to it, in fact. It was very dismissive.
So then you continued with the course when you came back, but in a different group.
Yes, but I only had about 2 weeks to go, which is one of the reasons why she didn't want me to leave, you know. But I travelled up. I was then posted to Corn to join the people at Bow Manor who did this Y work. Up until this time, I never heard of Y work and didn't know anything about it. But I met another girl on the train, and she was going up late as well, and she joined with me, Pat Drummond, and she remained my friend for the whole of the time there and afterwards.
This is at Quorn in Leicestershire?
Quorn, yes. And there's a big old house called Bow Manor. And the army had clearly moved in there. It was all aerials and things. But we were then, when we got there, we were told that what we were going to do was Y work. And Y work seemed to be all this secret stuff, which we knew nothing about. And we were told quite a lot. We were told that this turned out not to be true in the end, but they said that they had captured an Enigma machine in the desert, and were able to use this to decipher the codes. I heard afterwards that they had it a long time before. But that was 30 years later when I learned all this. And we were told that this was very, very secret. We were never to divulge anything to anybody about it. And we had, instead of the red cap army police that were normal, we had ones wearing blue caps. And they tended to haunt us a bit. If we went to the Salvation Army for beans on toast or anything, they were always hovering. Well, that sounds a bit like the Gestapo. It wasn't as bad as that, but you had to be very careful.
How do you spell Beau Manor?
B-E-A-U, Manor.
So you knew about Enigma even in those days?
We knew what it was. It was a name to us, really. And we knew that they had, as they said, cracked this code, and it was very important. And what we were going to do was listen into German traffic. And when we went on duty, we were each given a different station to listen in on. And I remember my first ones, they were called Greenshank, and I believe they were Gestapo. And the thing, we listened into the traffic, we listened to what they were sending, and it all went off, now I understand, to Bletchley. Bletchley, is that the name?
Yes.
And where it was deciphered. We worked shifts, three different shifts, and we had a different station on most occasions. Sometimes the station shut down and you had to search around for it. And it was quite interesting because sending Morse is like handwriting. You can recognise it. And if you were lucky and you could come upon the same man sending, the people there could work out where, say, the regiment or this group of Gestapo had moved off to. So they were able to tell where people were going. So we were told. And now I think this was all probably true. They were so careful about not telling us anything that for 30 years most of us had no idea at all of what we'd been doing. But there were interesting occasions. I was on the night when the Mona Anita Dam was bombed, and they came through in plain German language. Very occasionally they did this. They would call each other Dummkopf and things. And we learned about the bombing of the dam the next day in the newspapers and then realised what it was that we had been listening to. One girl, Ina Anderson, sat all night long when, I can't remember the name, but it was one of the Highland divisions in North Africa was captured. And she sat, and the Germans were very thorough, I believe, and they sent out every name, every number of every man who was captured, and she took her own husband's number. And he went into prisoner of war camp, and I don't know what happened in the end. I hope he came back. And then another thing which was a great bother, we used to get the fighter pilots up above us, and they used to talk in plain, in Artok, I think it was called, talk at each other, shout at each other all the time, and that used to interfere with the sometimes quite important stuff. We took five-letter groups,